The 5 days gone by, of course. Also, a couple of more nuggets from our latest poll from American Public Media. This is Market Flash. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 16th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So here we are, 2.5 weeks out or so. Lots of politics in the air, of course. We, though, are going to stay in our lane and do what we do best, figure out what happened in this economy in the past 5 days. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. Catherine Rempel is with the Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Anna, let me start with you and a question about what is at stake here for this economy, as there is clearly no relief coming, right? Unemployment numbers yesterday, still 850,000, 900,000 people. Industrial production is down. People are spending the savings they accumulated when they were getting the $600 of extra unemployment money. Okay, here's a starting question. How bad is it?
Well, I feel like I feel like I'm always so gloomy when I come on your show, but
no, that's okay.
The situation does seem like, you know, it's getting worse. I mean, the number of Americans in poverty has grown by 6 to 8 million in the last few months, based on some estimates. And, you know, it had fallen at the pandemic start because of government aid. That aid had helped push up household spending this summer and prop up the economy. But now it's really long gone. And I feel like we're definitely at risk of the kind of persistent economic malaise we saw after the financial crisis. So that aid really matters. But administration officials now say it's going to be hard, if not possible, to get something done before the election. You know, the president says he's grappling with Nancy Pelosi over an aid package. But, you know, the president still has pretty big divisions as well with Mitch McConnell. The president is floating figures north of $1.8 trillion for a potential aid package, but Senate Republicans say they're reluctant to go above $500 billion. So quite a lot of distance there between them.
Well, Catherine Rempel, that gets me to you and to a newsletter that you and I both subscribe to. It's the Politico Playbook, right? It's, you know, political details, gossip, items, and lots of news. Their afternoon update today had this as the subject line. We regret to inform you that Larry Kudlow is saying things again. Larry Kudlow, of course, is the president's chief economic advisor, one of them anyway. And he is, once again, saying things about this economy that are simply not true. And I wonder how troubling that is to you.
Yeah, I saw that. I wasn't sure whether to laugh or to cry when I saw that headline. Kudlow basically said we shouldn't be worried about the many, many people who are unemployed because they're all starting new businesses. And this is just creative destruction at work. And look, to the extent that new businesses are being founded, that's good news. We want more business creation. The real problem is that we've lost many multiples of that, presumably, you know, thousands and thousands of small businesses, not because their business models weren't viable, not because, you know, they were unproductive. They were shut down because of this massive force of, you know, this sudden shock of the pandemic. And for many of them, it became unsafe to continue operating. So it's not as if creative destruction we usually think of as something where like the unproductive businesses go out of operation because they don't. It's not that they don't deserve to survive, but they just can't compete. You know, that the strongest survive and get replaced. The ones that are not strong get replaced by stronger ones. That's not really what's going on here.
Right.
It's not that these companies were unproductive. They were viable. They're out of business because the pandemic still sucks and the government response to it sucks as well. And, you know, they're essentially the victims of mass government failure. At this point, I would argue. So celebrating this as, you know, a flourishing of American capitalism, which is what Kudlow had essentially said, I just think is a little bit wrongheaded.
Sure.
Yes, celebrate the entrepreneurs, but remember that entrepreneurs are also going out of business through no fault of their own.
Joseph Schumpeter is probably rolling over in his grave. I would also point out, Anna Swanson, that Mr. Kudlow said today, oh, yeah, we could totally get Republicans on board and pass this bill, which is simply not grounded, in fact, as Mitch McConnell told us yesterday. But I want to pull back from the American economic situation for a minute and point out two things internationally, which were times normal, we would be all over on this program. Number one, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, said today, yeah, we're going to have to do Brexit without a deal with the European Union, and that people just have to get used to that, number one. And number two, some reporting you've done, the European Union is going to be allowed by the World Trade Organization to tariff the United States over its Boeing subsidies. And I just, global trade goes on, and we seem not to be paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's the prospect right now of some really significant trade disruptions between the EU and the UK and between the EU and the United States. While both Europe and the United States have these weak economies and they're seeing no end in sight to their coronavirus cases. So, I mean, with Brexit, you know, this is just the latest deadline that they've blown through and talks will continue. But the prospect of this no-deal Brexit is definitely getting more real. And that could mean, you know, massive gridlock at the ports and all kinds of problems this December when there is this real cutoff. And with the WTO case you mentioned, the EU now has the right to impose a $4 billion of tariffs on the US in a trade case. And there was a similar case last year where the US had got permission to impose $7.5 billion mm-hmm. of tariffs on Europe. So the question is, you know, can everybody come to a deal here that would roll back both of those tariffs? Or are we just going to see more tensions and higher prices on both sides of the Atlantic now?
Catherine, let me just super quick pick up on something that Anna said in her first answer, which is that the recovery from this crisis is looking to be longer and more drawn out than maybe even after the great financial crisis. And given the international trade situation and America's standing in the world and all of those things, do you buy that?
It's so hard to know because we don't know the duration of the path of the pandemic. We don't know about when a vaccine is coming, et cetera. But there are a lot of reasons to worry, including the policy response right now. I mean, we saw what happened after the Great Recession when Congress withdrew fiscal aid, arguably much too soon. Yeah. That dragged on the recovery. It led to more layoffs at state and local governments. And it was just sort of an unforced error. And it seems like we didn't learn anything from that, unfortunately. State and local layoffs are probably coming down the pike now as well for the exact same reason. So the fact that we didn't learn our lessons before, coupled with all of these other risks that are out there on trade, on the pandemic, on uncertainty surrounding the election and whether it will have, whether it will lead to civil unrest, all of that, I think, bodes ill. I hope I'm wrong about that. Like Anna, I don't like to be gloomy on this show, but it's hard not to be really worried right now.
Catherine Rempel and at the Washington Post, Anna Swanson with the New York Times, doing what we do, man. I mean, just saying it like it is. Thanks, you two. Have a nice weekend. All right.
Thank you.
All right. We'll
Thanks.
See you on Wall Street today. It was fine, mostly steady. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a stretch back in the before times when it was a common refrain on this program to ask how much longer consumers could legitimately be expected to keep spending and supporting the then robust economy. We are going to dust the mothballs off that question today because this morning we learned retail sales were up 1.9% last month, more than double what had been expected. But as you just heard, there's no relief bill coming. The job market still ain't great. The virus is heading into its third wave. So how long do you think that consumer spending is going to last? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is on retail for us.
Jonathan White is an audio engineer at a performing arts center in Dallas. And when he was furloughed in June, he benefited from the additional unemployment money in the federal stimulus package.
I got 6 weeks of the $600 stimulus, which was great. I was making about as much as I would on a 40-hour week.
And he was spending mostly on accessories for his home office. He does some freelance work.
You know, I was at Best Buy probably once a week picking up something stupid here or there.
And then at the end of July, the money ran out. White started spending a lot less. And he says if there's no more stimulus from Congress, he's going to cut back on his holiday spending this fall, too.
I'm going to be reducing how much I spend on gifts, looking at visiting my mom in North New Jersey, seeing some friends in New York. You know, those prospects are slimmer now.
It's hard to say exactly why retail sales were higher than expected in September. Could be parents buying their kids clothes for back-to-school season, or the fact that auto sales are going up as people stop riding public transit and move to the suburbs. Sonia Lipinski at Alex Partners says people might also be doing some holiday shopping early. But regardless,
we're seeing a bit of a spike, but there's no additional dollars in their wallets that is going to maintain the spikes.
The first stimulus package propped up the economy. It gave people money to spend and allowed them to save more. But those savings have quickly been running out, according to a study out today from the University of Chicago and the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute. Eric Lund is a senior economist at the Conference Board.
At this point, it doesn't look like we're going to see any kind of stimulus be deployed until after the election, or possibly, you know, not until the first quarter of next year. And until we get sort of another package that comes in and offers some relief, I think we're risking a double dip recession.
Which would continue that downward spiral of less spending and more layoffs. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
They're taking the weekend off, but come Monday morning, Dave Brancaccio and the gang, the Marketplace Morning Report, all you need to know to start your economic day. Mobility is a big thing in economics. Most of the time, talking about mobility up or down the wealth and income ladder. We're going to do a story now, though, about actual mobility, people moving because of the pandemic and how it's changed how and where people live and work. The latest Marketplace Edison Research poll, which, as I think I've said, is out this week, dug into that a little bit. Nearly a quarter of Americans have recently moved or are considering moving in the near future because the shift to working from home has opened up some possibilities for those who can work from home. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Shamor Preston lives in Queens, New York, which was really scary in the early months of the pandemic and is getting scary again as new cases rise. Preston is 24 and just finished college, and he's looking for jobs someplace less crowded, maybe on the West Coast.
I think if I moved to another city, there will be more space, have more ability to not be around people so much compared to how New York City is, especially on the subway.
In our poll, among those who had moved recently or are considering moving, almost a third said one reason was to move away from an area impacted by COVID-19. United Van Lines has been making that happen for a lot of people, and it's been asking its customers what's behind their moves.
And what started as like a 5-7% back in March, April is now up to 14%. So 14% of those that move with us are saying one of the primary reasons was due to COVID.
The company's Tricia Schuler says health isn't the only concern.
I think it's also this shift in this newfound freedom for many people that now can work from anywhere. And so they're picking up and moving wherever they want to for the first time ever.
In our poll, nearly half of people who'd moved or thought about moving said the ability to work from anywhere was a factor. Not everyone has that flexibility, though. More than a quarter of people we surveyed said losing a job or income played a role. Overall, younger adults were the most likely to relocate. Devera Cohn is with Pew Research Center.
Now, that's logical because, of course, they're among the groups most affected both by job losses in the economy and also by the shutdown of college housing, where many were told to leave their dormitories.
Even those who didn't move because of the pandemic may have been influenced by it. Fernando Villagran in Alexandria, Virginia, needed a larger space so he could take care of his elderly mom and work from home.
I mean, I lived in a two-bedroom condo, so bringing my mom in there with her cat and my dog, it wasn't going to happen.
Now he has a home office, more outdoor space, and he's not so close to the neighbors. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It seemed to explain the world in a way that made sense to me.
Not the easiest thing. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials were up today 112 points, almost 0.4%, closed at 28,606. The NASDAQ down, though, 42 points, 0.3%, 11,671. S&P 500 basically flat. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow added 0.1%, the NASDAQ up 0.8%, S&P 500 rose 0.2%. Heading into the weekend, let's look in on gas prices, shall we? As tabulated by AAA, a gallon of regular on average is going to run you just under $2.18. That is a little bit more than a penny less than a week ago. Almost 48 cents a gallon, though, less than a year ago. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note 0.74% to the upside. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Now, here is a sentence I don't think I've said, well, in quite a while, probably, if ever, on this show. But here goes. U.S. wheat futures hit a six-year high today. Corn, 14-month high. Soybeans as well. Pork is up too. Also, not coincidentally, are coronavirus cases globally. Some countries, including China, are stockpiling for an uncertain pandemic winter amid concerns, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, over the global food supply chain.
World food prices have been rising for four straight months, according to a UN food index. Egypt, Jordan, and Taiwan are buying big to boost their pandemic stockpiles. Food and agriculture analyst Michael Magnovitz at Rabobank can think of other countries.
China in particular comes to mind as they've taken on a massive restocking program, but also India. Countries may increase their buffers to avoid any sort of supply side issues.
Issues such as lockdowns or border closures if the pandemic worsens. And when there's uncertainty, people tend to hoard, says psychologist Stephanie Preston at the University of Michigan.
I think people are trying to protect their own interests, even if it can cause, you know, what they call a commons problem, where then there's not enough for everybody.
When the pandemic first hit, there were widespread concerns about food protectionism. That didn't happen globally. Still, there have been bottlenecks in key developing countries. In South Africa, workers were banned from traveling to a packing plant for citrus, says Michigan State economist Tom Reardon.
And also, because wood was not classed as an essential item, the wood was not coming in to make packing crates, so the fruit couldn't be packed.
Globally, the prices of grain and meat continue to rise, just as more and more people can't afford them, given widespread job losses. Trade scholar Sherman Robinson at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says food insecurity is everywhere.
In the developed countries, it really depends on how good your social safety net is. So in the U.S. case, we are probably among the worst of the developed countries.
As the virus continues to surge, he says countries may be more tempted to hoard. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On the theory that we got to keep talking about this stuff, or we're going to stop talking about this stuff, and goodness knows the news fire hose makes it easy to get distracted, I want to get back to a series of conversations we've been having on the program in the past number of months about the systemic racism in this economy and what, at long last, it might be possible to do about it. We have talked to Fed presidents and community bank presidents. We have talked to Black economists who are men and Black economists who are women. And today we're going to talk to one of our Friday regulars, also a Black woman who is an economist, currently as principal and senior analyst at Edward Jones, Neela Richardson, of course. Neela, it's good to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you as well, Kai.
So in all the years that you have been coming on the show on Friday, I have never asked, well, there's a bunch of things that I've never asked, but one of them is how you came to be an economist. Give me the Neela Richardson backstory.
Oh, the backstory. It's not as interesting as the Marvel movie, but I went to Indiana University intending to major in political science because that's what you do. And realized when I was taking my first econ class that I really liked it. It seemed to explain the world in a way that made sense to me.
You've done a lot of work in your career in housing economics, right? You were at Freddie Mac during the run-up to the housing crash. You were at Redfin for a while. Housing is often looked at, home ownership specifically, as a way to level the racial wealth gap and income gap in this country. Do you buy into that?
I used to. When I entered the field in 2005, housing was hot, and I really bought into the idea that home ownership was one of two ways to create wealth in America for the middle class. It was either home ownership or entrepreneurship. As I went through that very, you know, turbulent period in the housing market, and in the subsequent years, as I watched house prices along the East and West Coast just take off, while many neighborhoods in the middle, many minority neighborhoods continue to languish, I realized that, you know, wealth creation through house price appreciation wasn't going to be the solution for everybody.
So if housing is not it, and not everybody can be an entrepreneur, what's your chosen way to reduce, if not eliminate, the racial wealth gap in America?
You know, that's a question that I think is much easier to answer than it is to do. When you think about the drivers of the racial gap, those drivers are historical, right? They have a long, long, centuries-long history. And what we're seeing in this moment is a growing realization among not just the African-American community, but all ethnicities, that these racial gaps are not with people, they're with places and things and institutions. You know, I've quipped before, and I do think this, that it's easier today to make money in the stock market. The reason why it's easier to make money in the stock market is not just because the stock market is just growing leaps and bounds. It's because a stock in Apple is the same for everybody. Because there is this institutionalized racism in America, the value, whether it's in a house or in human capital, that African Americans bring to the economy is often discounted. And so we got to figure out how to solve that discount.
But we do, for sure. And I agree. But to the point about the stock market, right? It is easier for your average white person in this economy to get the $3,000 that a share of Amazon costs than it is for the average black person, right? So even getting entree to the stock market becomes racially challenging.
Yeah, you're chasing your tail in that argument. I understand you have to have something to invest in the first place, and I get that. I get that. But what I saw during the housing crisis, and I'm not, you know, an anti. I live in a house, so I recommend it. So I'm not anti-housing any stretch of the imagination. But what I saw is that people spent a lot of money on housing, but that house didn't keep them from experiencing job loss. Wealth does that. I think the solution has to be really a focus on institutions. And how do you get people to care? It's not by appealing to a moral issue. We can all agree, or most of us can agree, that racism is a bad thing. But it's more than a moral issue. It's an economic issue.
Thanks, Neela. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
This final note on the way out today, two items, both of them real estate related. First of all, Mortgage rates. Freddie Mac, the big government-sponsored mortgage finance company, said this week the interest rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage fell to 2.81%. That is the cheapest mortgages have been in this economy in almost 50 years. So there is that. The flip side, though, comes to us from the Mortgage Bankers Association, which said this morning that in the second and third quarters of this year, that is April through September, 20% of everybody who's got a mortgage in this country got permission to delay or reduce their monthly payments. All right, we are out of here on a Friday afternoon, but not without your end-of-the-week moment of economic context. Sourced this morning to the United States Department of the Treasury, the federal deficit for the fiscal year that ended September the 30th. And remember, deficit is the annual shortfall, right? Was $3.1 trillion. Most of that, of course, emergency economic relief for the pandemic. And you're probably thinking right now, oh, that's a lot of money to be borrowing, right? Which the government is right now? Well, it is, but here's the kicker. The cost to the government of financing its debt, interest payments that it had to make, actually fell this year, even with all that extra spending, because, think about mortgage rates, because interest rates are so low. BJ Lederman did our theme music. Nancy Fargali is this program's executive producer. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.